Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age and the few years surrounding it. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we are talking about luxury ocean liner travel in the first half of the 20th century. The means in which some of our beloved Golden Age movie stars traveled from the US to Europe and back. This episode is a little different than our typical topics and format. Usually, I cover the life of a Golden Age star each week. So, why the departure from that? Well, what I'm sharing with you today is the kind of bonus content that I share over on Patreon. And I wanted to give you a little sampling of it so you can see what you're missing over there. I promise to get into the content in just a minute, but please stay tuned at the end for some more information about Patreon and what kind of bonus content is available there. Before I jump in, though, I want to give a very special shout out to our newest Patreon member. Thank you so much to Molly B. Listen after today's story to learn how you can be just like Molly. Thank you, Molly. Okay, let's get into some fun stuff. How our Golden Age stars used to get back and forth from Europe on those star-studded ocean liners of yesterday. Sit back and enjoy a little step back in time. Today, we can get from New York to London in about 7 hours. We just have to spend a few agonizing hours at the airport first before settling in for what we think is a long journey over the Atlantic Ocean. But our Golden Age stars from the first half of the 20th century would have been blown away to learn that one day, their 4 or 5 day voyage across sometimes unsettling waters would be reduced to a measly 7 hours in the air. Blown away. It all began with a joke at a meeting of the Great Western Railway in 1835. Yes, railway. A joke from the chief engineer about how they should extend their London to Bristol rail line to New York. Boy, would that open up worlds of possibilities in travel and business. Ha ha. Wait a minute. Maybe this could actually be a reality. A passenger ship with the purpose of getting a lot of people across the Atlantic Ocean, and to get them there in comfort and maybe even some style. Before long, the first ocean liner was being built, the 1,340-ton Great Western. She was the first built with that purpose in mind, but she wasn't the first to officially make a steam-powered transatlantic voyage. Once word was out that someone was working on this reality, the great race began to be the first to accomplish this feat. The first steamship to cross the Atlantic was the 703-ton Sirius, which was a seasoned ship that had already been traveling between Cork and London. The ship left Cork, bound for New York, on April 4, 1838, at 10 o'clock a.m. Only 40 passengers were aboard this grand trial voyage. The rest was cargo. 40 brave passengers. It was a rocky voyage, but the Sirius and her probably very seasick and very stressed out passengers reached New York on April 22nd, 18 days after they first set off. It was a big deal. The much larger, brand new Great Western arrived the very next day. And within just 6 months, three major steamship lines were traveling regularly between Britain and the U.S. But it wasn't the most comfortable experience in those very early days of transatlantic travel. And it was pretty risky crossing through those wild ocean storms. That had to change. Improvements in safety and comfort definitely had to be made. Enter Cunard. My mom is gonna really like this episode because she is a longtime hardcore traveler of the Cunard line. She and my dad before he passed, and she has traveled solo on Cunard since. She sailed on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth, which we'll talk about today, Queen Elizabeth II, and the Queen Mary II. Those grand ladies have taken her to England, Ireland, Scotland, Germany, France, and the Panama Canal. And most recently, my mom sailed on Cunard to Alaska. My husband and I actually did an Alaskan cruise the same summer as she did a couple years ago, but we slummed it on Royal Caribbean. Just kidding, I think Royal Caribbean is pretty darn nice too, but not nearly as fancy pants as Cunard. I don't think my mom is ready to say farewell to Cunard quite yet. So, Mom, listen up to hear about the icons who also traveled on the Queen Elizabeth. But first, some history. Samuel Cunard was the founder of the Cunard Steamship Company of Liverpool. And when he did so, he changed the course of transatlantic travel. Cunard's first priority was the safety of his passengers. There was no changing this. Safety first. Always. Second was speed. And third, comfort. The first transatlantic steamer from the Cunard line was the Britannia, and she completed her first voyage in July of 1840. The Britannia became the fastest east-to-west transatlantic voyage, earning the coveted Blue Ribbon title. Between Cunard's reliability, promise of safety, brilliant publicity, and a sweet contract with the Royal Mail, it became the premier ship line of the world. Cunard ships weren't the luxury liners they are known as today at the start of their rich history, though. Samuel Cunard was a very keen and intuitive man, and he followed the needs and desires of potential passengers and customized his ships and services around it. When the Great Immigration took place in the mid-1800s, he knew what was needed was affordable and efficient voyages. So Cunard's purpose for about 40 years was primarily transporting mail and immigrants. In the 40-year span between 1860 and 1900, Cunard transported approximately 2.5 million immigrants from Europe to the United States. One in five immigrants that traveled from Europe to the United States came here on a Cunard vessel. Immigration was a great priority for Cunard all the way up to about 1920. With such a great need for transatlantic travel, the race was on to make the biggest and the best ocean liner. Germany set precedence with a new level of style through their Hamburg America Company. And the British Cunard line followed suit in that style a few years later with the Lusitania and her sister ship, the Mauretania, in 1907. These girls brought Cunard back up to the head of the race again, making them the biggest and the fastest, getting across the Atlantic in 5 days. And now in a very elegant way, if the passengers could afford it. Most of the immigrants were traveling in steerage. The White Star Line followed this race of speed and luxury with the Olympic and the Titanic. Heard of it? These two became considered the most luxurious ships yet. The RMS Titanic prepared for her maiden voyage on April 10, 1912. She held a total of 2,345 passengers, 689 of them being first class and the remainder second and third. I know we've all seen the 1997 movie Titanic and probably the older films about the Titanic as well. But especially in James Cameron's 1997 film, we get a really clear and accurate look into what the experience was really like for the first-class passengers in 1912. But I'm going to talk about it a little bit anyways. The first-class suites were large and elegant, and different architectural influences could be found all over the ship in the first-class areas. The smoking room was said to have been paneled with the wood of one single enormous tree. And then there was the centerpiece of the entire elegant ship, the William and Mary Grand Staircase. The first-class passengers of the maiden voyage of the Titanic from Southampton to New York were living the best anyone ever had in history while crossing the Atlantic Ocean. Well, for 4 days at least. Everything changed on April 14, 1912, when the Titanic hit an iceberg and sank to the bottom of the ocean, taking the lives of over 1,500 passengers with her. Cunard's Carpathia was the first to arrive, rescuing survivors from the icy waters. Was this race to be the best and the fastest and the biggest too dangerous? Two years after the Titanic tragedy, Cunard released their third sister ship, the Aquitania. And this was the new best of the best. The most stunning ocean liner ever built. And she was quickly followed by Germany's Hamburg America Imperator. The elegance promised by the White Star Line with the Titanic was still being delivered by the two other powerhouses in shipbuilding, Cunard and Hamburg America. All would be recovered in terms of luxury travel, until another tragedy occurred just 3 years after the sinking of the Titanic. Cunard's Lusitania was struck by German submarine torpedoes on May 7, 1915 during World War I. The ship sank to the bottom of the ocean in just 18 short minutes, taking almost 1,200 passengers with her. At this point, all other ocean liners were either docked or converted into warships. They couldn't risk traveling with more passengers. Cunard's Mauritania and Aquitania were used as wartime hospital ships. Some ships were outfitted with artillery. When the war ended in 1918, the luxury ocean liners turned warships were used to transport soldiers back to their home countries. Let's talk about the Cunard Mauritania, which could accommodate over 2,100 passengers and about 800 crew members. This ship first set sail in 1907, so this is how you can picture some of our favorite silent film stars traveling to and from Europe. Cunard hired the best of the best architects and interior designers to create their opulent spaces for their first-class clientele. The first-class spaces were spread amongst 5 decks of the Mauritania. There was a library, a writing room, both stunning with attention to every fine detail. The library even had a huge white marble fireplace and a large glass dome in the center of the ceiling. There was also a music lounge, a smoking room, of course, a lush garden cafe, that's where you'd be able to find me the whole time, and the large and elegant dining hall, which spanned 3 decks. To get a feel of the dining room, picture this. Light oak walls, which contained beautiful ornate carvings, surrounded the almost 30-foot tall space that was, of course, topped with a beautiful glass dome. The chairs were upholstered with deep pink upholstery, and the floors were carpeted in a dark red. The entirety of the first-class spaces contained a ton of intricate, hand-carved wooden details, rich mahogany and walnut mixed with perfectly contrasting materials, marble floors, plush, expensive upholstered furniture, crystal chandeliers, ample windows, and beautiful glass domes to let in the sunlight. The White Star's Olympic was even more elegant and offered more luxurious spaces and amenities for her first-class passengers. She boasted a swimming pool and Turkish baths, a gymnasium, and a second restaurant apart from the main dining room. After their work carrying troops during World War I, both ships underwent heavy refittings in the early 1920s and came out even more elegant than before. The first-class staterooms in these Cunard and White Star ocean liners were comfortable and spacious for its high-class passengers. And the common areas of the first-class decks offered more than ever seen before on a passenger ship. Those large dining rooms and smoky lounges and music rooms, and even an exclusive ladies' lounge. The decor of these early luxury ships compared to a 5-star hotel in London or New York. That ornate woodwork, velvet upholstery, it was elegance all the way. Oil-burning lamps made way for electric bulbs for the first time in Cunard's Umbria liner. First-class passengers could sip and mingle on gorgeous leather and velvet furnishings, surrounded by Corinthian-style columns, marble, glass, mahogany, lush greenery, and large, beautiful canvas paintings. And, of course, the finest of dining. I'll talk more about that in a bit, you better believe it. Post-First World War and changes in U.S. immigration laws in 1921 signaled major changes in ocean liner travel. There wasn't such a great need for steerage class capacity with the number of immigrants traveling to the U.S. reduced, so second and third class accommodations were improved. And, as always, the first class accommodations were constantly being made bigger and more luxurious. You gotta keep those rich guys happy. This also set off a secondary purpose of luxury ship travel, more than just getting from point A to point B. Vacation cruises. With the changes in more affordability and comfortable accommodations for more middle-class passengers, this opened up great opportunities to see the world in which only the wealthiest people were able to do until that point. The most highly acclaimed ocean liners of the 1930s were the French Normandy and the Cunard Queen Mary. France's Normandy was unveiled in 1935 and was the first ocean liner to reach over 1,000 feet in length. And she could cross the Atlantic in a record-breaking 4 days. The main dining room of the Normandy sat 1,000 diners and was adorned in an elegant French design of bronze and hammered glass. The garden room had real birds in ornate cages to finish off the feel of the space, which I don't like one bit, but they didn't really care about animal welfare much in the 1930s. The ship housed two elaborate penthouses, each with their own private sun decks. There were first and second class swimming pools and tennis courts. The Normandy met her end during World War II when she started on fire during her conversion to a warship, and she could not be saved. Rivaling France's Normandy was Cunard's Queen Mary, which was debuted in April of 1936. And on her first trip to New York, she beat the speed record again, making it across the Atlantic in under 4 days. And boy, was she fancy. She was a stunner. She was also over 1,000 feet in length. She weighed over 80,000 tons, contained over 10 million rivets, over 2,000 portholes, and 2,500 square feet of glass. The interior of the Queen Mary was remarkable, still is. It contained the largest apartment to have been built inside of a ship, and the common areas were the height of elegance. Cunard's Queen Elizabeth joined her sister ship, the Queen Mary, in 1940. But the world was in the midst of its Second World War, so she was painted gray and worked as a troop ship before she even transported passengers. Both Cunard's Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth were used in this capacity during World War II. Between these two Cunard ships, 1,243,538 Allied troops were carried. On one individual voyage, the Queen Mary carried 16,683 soldiers. Her typical capacity for leisure travel was 2,139. Let me say those numbers again. She carried 16,683 soldiers on one individual trip during World War II, and her normal passenger capacity was 2,139 people. It was packed. Adolf Hitler did not appreciate this contribution that the Queens were providing to his enemies. He offered a $250,000 reward to the German U-boat commander who could shoot down either of the ships. Luckily, both ships survived the war and were applauded for their great contributions to the Allied forces. Once through another long and devastating war, as well as the Great Depression, Americans were eager to travel to Europe again. The Queen Mary stayed on top as the best ocean liner, but the Queen Elizabeth was the largest. Let's talk a little more about life aboard the Queen's. First, fun fact about the naming of the Queen Mary. They had intended on naming her after Britain's beloved, long-reigned, late Queen Victoria. Cunard's chairman went to then-Crown King George V and said they wanted to name their new great ocean liner after England's greatest queen. The king replied, "Yes, my wife would be delighted." So, of course, not willing to offend the king, Cunard named the ship after King George V's wife, Queen Mary of Teck. The Queen Victoria would debut as a Cunard cruise liner decades later. A voyage on either the Queen Mary or the Queen Elizabeth during the post-war 1940s was a comfortable, stylish, and luxurious event. Again, for its first-class passengers at least. And not terrible for the lower classes. Here is what life would have been like on the Queen's during a typical transatlantic voyage after their refittings in 1946. Each of the Queen's offered weekly voyages for their transatlantic passengers, so plenty of opportunities to get to Europe or vice versa. The Queen Mary had two swimming pools, tennis courts, a large library, beauty salons, a nursery for children, you don't want them getting in the way of your fun, dog kennels, and even movie theaters. It had everything you would need for your four-day voyage across the Atlantic. During her refitting after World War II, she was even upgraded with air conditioning, a pretty big deal. No first-class cabin was the same on the Queen Elizabeth. Each room was designed as a unique masterpiece of design. A few stars who enjoyed traveling in style on the Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth were Fred Astaire, Greta Garbo, Clark Gable, Marilyn Maxwell, Frank Sinatra, Marlene Dietrich, Audrey Hepburn, Bob Hope, Elizabeth Taylor, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and Bing Crosby. Elizabeth Taylor traveled on the Queen Mary with her two poodles, making several voyages together. On July 9, 1948, Clark Gable delayed departure of the Queen Mary by 18 minutes as he took his time saying goodbye to his girlfriend of the time. This was towards the end of his long swinging bachelor period, so I'm not certain who the enticing lady that made 2,000 people wait on board was. These stars and all the other first-class passengers on the elegant Queen Mary in the late 1930s and 1940s dined on the most exquisite meals throughout their voyage. I found a dinner menu from the RMS Queen Mary from the 1930s. So allow me to share with you some of the dining options presented to Clark Gable, Marlene Dietrich, or Greta Garbo while they sailed the seas on the Queen Mary. For your main course, you could choose from the following poultries: spring chicken, guinea chicken, jumbo squab, poussin, quail, or woodcock. I just want to point out that squab and poussin are baby birds, not cool. You could accompany that with one of the following vegetables: artichokes and butter sauce, spinach and cream, string beans, or fried eggplant. And then your potato. You could have boiled, rissolet, Saratogas, Windsor, or puree, which I assume is just a fancy way to say mashed. I have no idea what rissolet, Saratoga, or Windsor is because I'm not fancy. Your salad dressing options were French, Thousand Island, vinaigrette, and paprika dressing. Desserts included souffle pudding, peach melba, chocolate eclairs, petit fours, strawberry sundae, and a few other things that I'm not even going to try to pronounce. My couple of years of high school French knowledge is packed so deep into the archives of my brain, they are virtually unreachable. Another Queen Mary menu I found was a luncheon menu from 1950. Again, so many fancy offerings, but a few that stood out to me were sardines, smoked eel, braised celery and grated cheese, which does not sound exciting at all, calf's liver and bacon, roast lamb in mint sauce, veal and lamb pie. Can you just leave those baby animals alone, please, rich people? roast suckling pig with applesauce, and my favorite, rolled ox tongue. How many orders of that do you think they serve today? I'm not sure if I've ever mentioned this, but I'm a 30-plus year vegetarian, so no ox tongue for me. I may not like meat, but I do sure love desserts. Aboard the Queen Mary in 1950, you could order lemon meringue pie, roll jam pudding, compote of apricots, plums, and peaches, or ice cream, chocolate, banana, or pineapple. I have never seen pineapple ice cream, but if you were to put it in front of me, I would totally eat it. They also had about 20 varieties of cheeses to choose from on that luncheon menu. So once all of that lunch settled, it was time for some lounging on one of the sun decks or playing in one of the organized deck games. Some of the games you could engage in with your fellow passengers on the game deck were deck quats, which I think is basically ring toss, bull board, which I had to look up. This game involves throwing discs onto a board of numbered squares. The discs were made of lead and covered in leather. Tug of war, rope tag, and an old-timey version of American gladiators jousting using pillows and perched atop a suspended log. A glorified rich white man pillow fight. Then there was a game called Placing the Pig's Eye, which looks like it was kind of like pin the tail on the donkey. But the participant is blindfolded and has to put an eye on a large outline of a pig on the floor using a large pole. Sling the Monkey looked really interesting. The participant is hung upside down with rope tied around his ankles, and then he has to use his hands to walk backwards along the deck and use chalk to draw lines on the deck. The person who has the furthest away line wins the game. Apparently, this game would cause quite the uproar of laughter from the onlookers. And of course, there was shuffleboard. You gotta have shuffleboard. You would also find men in the first class lounges enjoying a game of cards, checkers, or chess. And I hope the ladies had some fun in their ladies' lounges too. The U.S. finally entered the ocean liner game in 1952 with the unveiling of the SS United States. And just 6 years after her maiden voyage across the Atlantic, transatlantic travel was about to change forever. In 1958, the first commercial jets began their trips across the Atlantic Ocean. Within that first year, airlines like TWA and Pan Am had dominated the transatlantic travel population. Just like that, two-thirds of transatlantic passengers were traveling by air and just one-third by sea. Travelers could get across the ocean in 7 hours opposed to 4 days. The once top-class form of travel, the only form of travel, across the Atlantic had been taken over in the blink of an eye by airplanes. Most of the ocean liners then transitioned to cruise ships. Some survived this transition, and some did not. Cunard and White Star merged in the mid-1930s, and Cunard is still sailing strong to this very day. You can still travel in a kind of old-school luxury, similar to a passenger ocean liner days aboard a Cunard ship. Or you could treat yourself to a more modern style of luxury on a line like Regent or Seabourn. Or if neither of those is an option, the iconic Queen Mary is retired from travel and anchored in Long Beach, California. You can tour her or even stay in one of her beautiful Art Deco staterooms for a couple of nights. You can even have a truly unique wedding and get married on the Queen. My mom and I plan to visit the Queen Mary this winter, and I cannot wait. Let me know if you have been on the Queen Mary, or any of the Queens. So, how did you like this little step back in time, taking a peek at how our beloved Golden Age stars traveled to and from Europe? It would be so fun to go back in time, wouldn't it? If you enjoyed this episode, you should really hop over and check out the bonus content that I have available on Patreon. First of all, what is Patreon? Well, it is a site dedicated to connecting content creators with their communities. It's a place where you can throw a little support to your favorite creators or artists, and they can say thank you by offering you some great content. In the case of podcasts, that means bonus episodes that are not available on the regular feed. Molly just joined the Stars of the Golden Age Patreon community, so she will get a monthly bonus episode each month, a monthly Movie of the Month recap episode, and a monthly cocktail party episode. Plus, she gets the entire backlog of bonus content. Do you want to be swimming in amazing content like Molly? Let me tell you a little bit more about each of these monthly bonuses. First, the Movie of the Month. Each month, I choose a classic film for us all to watch on our own time, if you wish, and then I release a recap episode about the movie, and I also share some fun facts about them. These episodes are 15 to 20 minutes long, usually. This month, our Movie of the Month is The Great Ziegfeld. Sometimes they are comedies, sometimes they're dramas, sometimes noirs, sometimes musicals, a little of everything. Then there is the super fun cocktail party. In that, I first share a vintage cocktail recipe, the history of that cocktail, and I am of course sipping on that very cocktail myself. I try my best to share a non-alcoholic version of each cocktail too. And then I dig through my piles of old vintage magazines and read you some juicy celebrity gossip or other fun content from them. I have a bunch of old Photoplay and Modern Screen magazines, so that's where I find most of it. There is some really, really fun stuff in those magazines. It's a super fun little bonus episode to share with you. That's about 20 minutes as well each month. And then there is the full-length bonus episode that is available to the Oscar tier patrons. In these 30 to 45-minute episodes, I talk about all kinds of interesting topics related to Hollywood's Golden Age. Past topics have been history of the Hollywood sign, Dean Martin celebrity roasts, black history in Hollywood, history of Nickelodeons and movie theaters, old Hollywood studio rules, Golden Age nightlife, Hollywood casting couch, and more. This month I talked about old Hollywood film set tragedies. And next month I'm talking about the Hays Code. I'm telling you, join our Patreon community and it'll make you smarter. You will learn so much and have so much cool information to share with your friends. So if you want to get all of that like Molly B, go to patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast and join us. You can find the link in the show notes as well. There are two levels of support, the Emmy tier for $4 a month, and the Oscar tier for $8 per month. And I'll send you a sweet Stars of the Golden Age sticker to slap on wherever you slap your stickers. I promise you will not regret it. Please join us. Being a solo podcaster of a research-based show is a lot of work. My laundry is piled up, dust bunnies are collecting in the corners of my house, my friends think I don't like them anymore. I seriously spend all of my free time researching and editing this podcast. I don't dislike it, far from, I love it. But it is just a ton of work and takes an insane amount of hours each week. I honestly didn't realize just how much when I began, and I will admit I probably put in way more hours than I have to and that others probably do, because I'm afraid of failure, and I really strive for perfection in my finished product. I could use AI for writing and editing, but I refuse to. I will never. I'm old school. I'm not going to rely on artificial intelligence to release something that has my name attached to it. I could run my recordings through an AI program and have it done in a couple of minutes, but instead I meticulously go through every single second of my recordings to make sure that every pause is perfect between each segment. Between each word. And then I go through it again to add the music. I want these individuals I cover to be presented to you in the most dignified way I can do. And I refuse to put that incredible responsibility in the hands of AI. So I will continue to let the dust bunnies build up. I mean, I do eventually vacuum. But I'm just trying to say that I choose to put the extra time in for you. And I just wanted to lay out the process so you know that I'm doing the very best I know how to do. If you listen to many podcasts until the end, you hear that long list of credits recited by the host. You have a person or two doing research, a person or two doing editing, a producer, a sound mixer, an audio engineer. In fact, I just listened to one history series that listed 6 separate producers. I'm happy for them, I really am, and they are sure able to put out some outstanding content with all of those professionals involved. I bet they don't have dust bunnies in the corners of their home, though. Guys, here at Stars of the Golden Age, it's just me. I'm the writer, I'm the host, I'm the editor, I'm the audio engineer, and I'm all 6 of the producers. I'm not trying to complain here, I just want to put it into perspective because I think it's something most people just don't consider. I know I didn't before I started my own podcast. So please, knowing all of that now, consider supporting the show on Patreon if you're able. Or if you don't feel like supporting this show, please help out your other small indie podcast that you like. They are working their butts off to turn out content for us, for pretty much free. I support a few of my favorite shows, and honestly, I don't even really listen to the bonus content that I get from my support. I don't really have time to listen to it. But I do just want to support their hard work. Okay, that's about as much as you'll ever hear from me about that. Again, if you do feel inclined, you can learn more at patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast. Before I go, I want to share a review of the week. I want to say I've received some really lovely emails and messages in the last couple of weeks from people who are loving the show. I want to thank you all so much. It truly helps keep the momentum up to put out the best work I possibly can. I would not be here without your amazing support. I will share some of those words soon, but this week's review comes from Ferris, who said, "Excellent. One of the best podcasts ever. Thank you." And thank you, Ferris. I'm hoping to keep popping out interesting life stories for years to come. I do also want to share another review. This one's from Joey on Spotify. He said, "Tried to listen, but found the background musical too much." I replied to Joey on Spotify, and I hope he saw it, but I do want to remind everyone that I release 2 versions of each episode each week. If you're not into background and transition music, there is a sensory-sensitive version of each episode released as well. That one is just my voice, nothing more. The music-added episodes come out Tuesday, and the same content, minus any music besides the intro and outro music, comes out on Wednesdays. So there's something for everyone. So again, if you want to hear more interesting information like today's topic, you know what to do. Head on over to patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast and join our community. Not only will I give you a ton of great content as a thank you, but you will have that nice fuzzy feeling knowing that you're supporting a hardworking little indie podcaster to keep on trucking and keep on sharing cool content with you. And if you don't feel like supporting this show, remember to please throw a little support to your other favorite podcasts if you're able to. I'm telling you, they are working their keisters off and putting a lot of time into getting their content out to you. I support my favorite podcasts, and you should consider it too. Thank you, guys. For this episode, I used a documentary titled Great Liners by Absolute History, a documentary titled Big Old Boats, a documentary titled The Golden Age of Cruising by Ritzy Travel Guide, a documentary titled Atlantic to Titanic, The Evolution of Ocean Liners by Ocean Liner Designs, Cunard.com, QueenMary.com, and GGArchives.com.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners. Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.